man. This aircon is racist.
I've never ever been a spy.
Can the DBS bank loot?
The problem is that Pinky.
I'll never subject myself to white men. I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a ship.
Sergeant at arms, can you please come in?
Point of order.
Good day and welcome to another edition of Sunday Times Politics Weekly with me, Amil Amrao, here at the Sunday Times Studios. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. In studio this week, we have our esteemed Sunday Times Politics colleagues in the studio, Zimasa Matiwane, Zingisa Mvumvu, and Apiwe de Klerk. Guys, how are you all doing? It's been a long week already.
Yeah.
That just says it all. But listen, there's been a lot going on in the news, and a lot of people are talking about one singular thing that sort of made the public discourse and defined it last week, and that's the National Health Insurance Bill. The up-and-coming one, it's going to take some time to get to full implementation, but people are worried already. Maybe because they don't fully understand it, or maybe because it's just rubbish.
Yeah.
For all we know, let's get into the facts of it and try to explain exactly what's going to happen, and whether, and you guys can decide whether or not you should be worried or not, and how it's going to go forward. So anyway, in its preamble, it becomes evident that the bill is well-intentioned, right? It's targeted at addressing social economic inequality, and I quote here, to improve the quality of life of all citizens, and to free the potential of each person. Now, with every single government bill, we're going to get this rhetoric at the beginning about how it's going to change people's lives for the better. We seldom really see it, to be honest, in this country. Now, according to the bill, the National Health Insurance Fund will be financed through mandatory payment that aims to achieve sustainable and universal access to quality healthcare services. And this fund will serve as the single purchaser and the single player of healthcare services in the country by pooling finances and strategically purchasing healthcare services, medicine, and health-related products from accredited and contracted service providers. So basically, the government will now be in charge of the healthcare system entirely. So that's where the first bit of worry comes in.
Yeah.
But I think what people were mostly talking about is the implications on their pockets, because for most people, this is the biggest cause of concern. We'll get into the other causes of concern, like what's going to happen to medical aids? Will I now have to go to RK Khan Hospital in KZN, you know, and have a deathbed waiting for me there? But basically, it's going to be paid for largely by an increase in taxes, and that's the scary part. So this includes taxes paid by employers and workers, as well as an increase in personal income tax. So what do we think about this, guys? Where do we start on the NHI bill?
First of all, the idea of universal health care, that we all need access to health care, that just because I was born by accident of nature in Tembisa, in a shack, I don't deserve to, you know, get healthcare quality that is similar to Amil.
Why me? Why me?
Because you're not born by accident. You go to Netcare. You see, you know, I like that idea. It addresses that sort of imbalance.
I feel a butt coming along, guys.
Just as the same as, you know, it's like access to water or access to electricity. Health should be like that.
Exactly.
But <There we go. laughs> look, as things stand, a lot of us, the normal citizen and even industry players, are in the dark of what is actually going to be, you know, the nitty-gritties of it. Are medical aids going to die?
Yeah.
Will this mean I must go to Barra? Chris Ani Paraguana, for those who don't know, or will it mean that finally I will get a chance to go to Mill Park?
I think
those things are not explained yet.
Exactly.
I see the ministry is saying a white paper is going to speak to those issues, and a money bill is going to speak to that. But just the release of it has caused a lot of panic, and you know, they are not doing themselves favors and in that department by not at least trying to take everyone along with them. it's like they place a bill and say, well, we don't know. Maybe Treasury would come and say, it might be 5 rand more, or they're not taking us along. You would expect a department which has had, a pilot project on this, which cost 4 billion?
Exactly.
To at least have a proper idea. Okay, this, in the pilot, this is what we've done, and it will more likely be, these are more likely going to be the numbers, and this is how it's going to operate.
This is the thing for me personally. I wish that when you make a bill public, that with that bill, you come out with an implementation, a proper explanation to how this is going to work. Mm-hmm. Because just dropping a bill out there, which is very technical, and spans over 10 years, doesn't explain the small nitty-gritties about what people actually want to know. Yes, it tells you what's going to happen and how it's going to happen in the country, but what it doesn't tell you is how it's going to affect you directly. You know, it doesn't say, okay, for example, instead of you paying 1,500 rand for medical aid, now you're going to pay 800, for example. Everyone will pay 800, and you'll have access to this, 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 and this, and you might have to get medical aid to cover this, this, and this. It doesn't tell us this, so that's why it leaves the sort of gap. And this is where people start to worry, Zingisa.
Can I interject just a bit? Sure. Which is close to the point I was making. It's not, those things are not, if you would say, if someone pays now 1.5, you know roughly what a medical aid covers. And you know roughly what is basic health care, and you know what you are most likely not going to cover.
Exactly.
So you can, from now, make an estimate as a department. Mm. They should. This thing was introduced way back.
Yes, exactly.
It's not like it's something that was that is still in creation stages and whatnot. There has been a pilot. So you should at least say we will charge roughly between 1.5 to 2,000 for people who are earning between here and here. And for you see what I'm saying? Mm. It's not there. We it's not coming out. So that's my worry.
Mm. Look, first of all, let me be blunt and put my opinion and view.
We always love to hear as controversial as it always is.
Of course.
This one is opposed. I know.
I can safely and say that this thing is going to fail. And I'll expand on why I'm saying that.
Tell us.
First of all, I'll start with the issues that UAPU was raising. One, we had a pilot project in Limpopo and the Eastern Cape. Eastern Cape being where public health care is in complete shambles.
Of course.
Which we've had since when? More than 5 years? Is it 5 years or more?
No. When Motsoaledi was launching this thing was what? Around 2012, 2013.
Yeah. So roughly 5 years we've had a pilot project. But me and you and everyone else don't know how that pilot project went. Well, unless, I know to a certain degree because I've gone to, health portfolio committees in the Eastern Cape sometime last year. And what I heard there was not so impressive. I am shocked that the government before this didn't take us along, as Abu was saying, to say, in the pilot project, this is what we've experienced. If there were challenges that can be addressed in the now fully blown implementation, these are the challenges and this is how we plan to address them. The fact that they are not even telling us about how the pilot project went is what worries me the most. And that is part of the reason I'm saying I don't think they know what they're doing and they are fully confident that this thing is going to work. And then secondly, we've got issues of infrastructure. I spoke about the Eastern Cape. Eastern Cape is a typical example. I'm glad that they actually started the pilot project there, which they are not telling us about. Infrastructure there is in complete shambles. And also, I feel it's short-sighted to try to balance things from this level, things that are not balanced. You know, public hospitals, there's issues of shortage of nurses, a shortage of doctors. Not because there are money issues in terms of salaries, not because people are unhappy, but people are unhappy with the working environments. There's not enough equipment. There's overcrowding, ridiculous long working hours. You know, people are just frustrated, and they're frustrated because of the environment that is not conducive. Mm-hmm. Has the government done anything to improve those environments first in the public hospitals so that when you bring that on par with what is working being the private sector, at least there's some degree of professionalism within the public health care and equipment and everything that works there, that makes the environment conducive for working. But
well, last week the health minister William Keyes had a press briefing where he outlined the NHI bill and answered some questions around it. Let's take a listen to a little bit of what he said.
For too long has our health care system operated in an unsustainable and unjust manner. The public health care system shoulders the lion's share of the disease burden in this country, looking after 84% of our population with less resources than the private health system that services only 16% of the population. The NHI seeks to optimize the available resources by pooling existing public funds and engaging the entire quantum of the sector so that in the end there is a single purchaser of healthcare services. The NHI will benefit all South African citizens, permanent residents, refugees, inmates, designated foreign nationals, and all children, so long as the system is accessed at the appropriate level of entry and the correct level, correct referral pathway is followed. Services will be free at the point of care. The medical aid industry will have no trouble adapting to the changing environment as they have successfully done in the past by developing financial products and services that provide complementary cover.
Well, there you have it. So basically, my big issue here is that how do you have universal healthcare when the quality of all your facilities are marginally different? So you've got, as our peer was talking about, Netcare, Mill Park, for example, and there's no promotion in there.
Yeah.
But basically, let's take a private hospital. You've got a certain level of healthcare, which you're paying an exorbitant amount through your medical aids for. Whereas your average citizen in this country does not have access to those facilities, but has to go to a normal government institution. And they're miles apart. I think we could all agree on that. So where do you start to give the useful implication? Where the thing is, if you had, for me, every single hospital facility and healthcare facility on the same level in the country, then I don't mind.
Yeah.
Because now we can all receive the same amount of healthcare across the board. And I don't mind facilitating payment for everybody else. That's fine with me. But now, how does it work? You know, where do we go? Like, now... And other questions come in for the doctors. We've already got a mass exodus of doctors and healthcare professionals in the country. Will this scare them off even more?
So government has failed totally to create a public healthcare system that works for citizens that cannot buy healthcare. Mm. So what now they are trying to do is to hijack what wasn't created by government, wasn't created for people that cannot afford healthcare. And I'm sorry to say this, but now they are trying to crowd that, and I feel like they are going to mess it up also. But look, ultimately, things like healthcare, things like access to water, electricity, and education, they should not be commercialized.
Exactly.
Everyone should have access to them. So
and
it's
good
not
quality services in that respect as
good,
well.
Good quality services. Mm. So it's not the fault of people who cannot afford medical aid. Mm. It's the fault of government. My biggest worry with the NHI is that administratively, I don't think our government has capacity to manage this.
Exactly. Because government wants to be the payer of medical workers. So they want to pay doctors, they want to pay hospitals, they want to pay for medicine. And we all know Zimbabwe.
They want to contract
everything out. So basically then they would have to pay the doctors after their services are rendered. They would have to pay hospitals. They would have to pay for medicine. They would be doing all the admin.
No.
And we already know
government,
as you were
government
saying,
struggles to pay SASSA.
Yeah.
To have a contract that works to pay SASSA. So how are we going to trust government with a budget, an estimated budget of what, 450 million to implement this thing?
Billion. And as you say, our government has really not covered itself in glory in terms of how it delivers on issues.
I've always failed to understand when it comes to healthcare is that What exactly is the problem? Why is government failing the people when it comes to providing healthcare? Mm. Is it because there isn't money? Or is it... Because some of the problems, Amil, are so...
They're absolutely dire, aren't they?
It's a hospital that is falling apart. For example, the walls are falling apart. Mm. Why is government not fixing that?
Because now they are creating an impression that the public healthcare is not working because there's an elite healthcare that works for certain individuals.
Which is not the truth. We pay medical aids, but we also pay tax, so we contribute towards them fixing
public healthcare.
Public healthcare.
And also on the funding issue, Amil, when they say taxes and stuff like that, I'm not prepared to pay more tax. I mean, let me just speak.
Are you going to go to Australia?
Well, maybe I'll go there.
I think that doctors will actually go to Australia or wherever, because right now, although the public healthcare system trains mostly specialists, once they are qualified, they leave. Because they cannot take the pain of seeing patients die because there isn't
resources
to help them. So they leave and go to the public sector.
To the private sector. So,
but look, some of the fears here that are being raised across the board, some of them are childish, though.
Guys, what do you think? Tell me.
Why are you scared of queuing? Why are people scared of not choosing themselves to go to specialists? I mean, it makes sense that someone must be referred to a specialist. Specialists should be dealing with cases
that are referred to them.
Yeah, I mean, if I was a specialist and then there's someone who's coming here with a headache, then it's just a normal headache. They should be taking a grandpa for a
stent. Can I tell you why? Can I give you an example?
Okay, yeah.
Here's an example. If you go to a public hospital and you have a lump in your breast, the chances of you finding a diagnosis, you will be dying, you'll be stage 4 cancer. I'm talking about this from personal experience, from a family personal experience kind of situation.
So people
want to have access to the best. That means easy access to specialists. Uh-huh. The examples that we have of the public health care system tells you that you will go to the specialist when you are 2 minutes to die.
Wait, no. I think you're missing my point. The point is, GPs, if this were to work perfectly, it would mean any general practitioner. It doesn't necessarily mean at Baragwana. There are GPs who are having their own surgeries.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who are practicing privately.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is the introduction to say, you can't just go to a specialist. Yeah. You need to go and get a diagnosis when you are sick, and it will teach us as a nation to be careful and serious about our healthcare. When you have a problem, you go to the nearest
primary healthcare.
They check you up and then they pick up those things.
But
if they don't, well, it's not like, you see, there is an argument which I struggle to understand by many people in the middle class, as you were. It's as if everyone is dying in the rural areas and the townships where they can't afford medical aid because they are going to this public hospital, which is not the case.
There's
no stats about chief. The townships are full now. You can go and calculate. People are not dying in massive numbers because of the poor state of healthcare.
But
it is poor.
But people who are not supposed to be dying are dying.
No.
That's the problem.
You're not getting my point. My point is, if then it works perfectly, so this argument that I can't choose which doctor I must go to, why must I be told to go to a GP first before I go to a specialist? So specialists are there for those cases where someone was probably misdiagnosed and they are at their last moments, and then a specialist would then come. Now imagine that specialist should be dealing with you. You are dying in your deathbed and they are busy dealing with someone who has a headache. They should
Can I ask an important question?
So primary, if this is going to work, the first
Which
point
not,
of contact
yeah.
It's not going to work, but
you are a pessimist.
Make your point.
At the first point of contact you have with healthcare should be a clinic, isn't
of course.
It?
Yeah.
So when you get there, when they look at you, if the nurse does not know how to assist you, they refer you to a doctor. The doctor that gets there is a GP. The GP looks at you and decides, but okay, yes, you have a problem in your eye, but you need a specialist who is going to deal with it. Then they refer you. But you find that in some instances, instead of needing to go to a specialist, a nurse who could have assisted you just because it was something that was when you had a problem with your eye, it was just China. When you just need glasses, you see.
Do we have enough health personnel to serve everyone?
No,
we don't.
That's another problem.
Another
problem.
We don't.
So it's okay for
it's not okay.
the middle class to hog the specialist, but
So what I'm saying is,
the
introduction of the NHI did not reduce specialists.
That is true. Yeah.
So that argument that we don't have enough specialists has got nothing to do with the introduction of NHI. What we as middle class people are saying is because of our own fears that now I'm going to be like a Brother Steve from, when I had acquired so much that I am paying. Yeah, fine, you are paying. But some of the things that your medical aid ends up paying for are unnecessary. Remember, I had a very interesting conversation with Mawande Mvumvu here. Zingisa Mvumvu, about you going to your doctor and then they go to do tests. When they go to do tests, when those blood tests come back, they come back and send them to the doctor. But if you had actually gone
to the laboratory
yourself, you could have saved $1,000.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, we were saying with Apiwe, just on his point, not that I agree with him, I don't agree with his views, but on this point, I think he's correct. Because I mean, for instance, when we were talking about this thing, I was making an example of how when you want to do a mere HIV test, going to a doctor to refer to take your to refer your samples. First of all, that doctor is going to charge you about $500 for consultation just to write a letter to a laboratory that you could have gone to direct to say, I want this guy tested for HIV. You go to the laboratory, they take your blood samples, they send back the results, which is either positive or negative, a simple explanation to your doctor. You go back to your doctor, you pay $500 again, on top of having paid the laboratory as well to test, which charges you more when you are referred by a doctor. Like, that whole process would be about 1.3 if you do it via a doctor, but that process can be as cheap as 150 if you go directly to the laboratory for them to do your test. They just take your blood, you go back to them the following day, they give you results, done, you go home. And on Apiwe's point, now the doctor could be dealing with much more serious issues rather than dealing with a Zimasa who's there wanting to know their status.
I think the most important thing here is, guys, that people who cannot afford your quality health care, people, cancer patients, people who are suffering from massive dread diseases, now have access to, will or should, when this NHI bill is implemented, have access to the best care.
Yeah.
So we've got a fine line here, and somehow and some way, I don't know how it's going to happen, but we've got until 2026. Government's going to have to make a plan on how they're going to do this efficiently and properly, because that's the most important part.
Ultimately,
with all that said,
the
examples we have seen with how our government provides services to us, I'm one of the most worried people.
Yeah.
Imagine
yeah.
Home Affairs in China, when you go there to queue since 5 in the morning.
Exactly.
I'm one of the most worried. You see people at municipalities which used to have running water, those taps are dry.
Exactly.
With ESCO power outages.
Are we saying that we don't have a problem with the bill, but we just have a problem with the government that's implementing it?
I don't have a problem with the bill.
It's a brilliant idea, Amir, but the skepticism and pessimism emanates from the fact that our government is just doesn't have a good record, and this is a massive project of 57 million people, well, and the 10 million foreign nationals.
Our government
is
just
not going to cope. Actually, doing about foreign nationals. What are we going to do about those undocumented ones that our mayor, Herman Mashaba, keeps on being attacked for stating facts?
So it does say, that asylum seekers and what the bill describes here as illegal immigrants will only be entitled to emergency medical services and services, I quote here, for notifiable conditions of public health concern.
At whose expense?
So like that's contagious diseases.
Yeah.
At the government's expense.
No, at me and you expense. You see, the problem I have with, again now, I just want to emphasize the point of the how problematic illegal immigrants can be.
Wait.
No, wait.
Because
it's a free country, let the man have his shoes off you.
In this instance, for instance, Amil, you see, it says for whatever, but there will be a way that they will be covered through NHI. But these are people, some of them, who are making money within the country. They are paying no taxes. They are no one even knows that they are making money. But me and you, who are registered, who are known by Home Affairs, well, we may be foreigners ourselves, but we are known. At least we have an ID. Are paying taxes, therefore, at least, and as you say, it's not only people who are working who are going to pay taxes, even other form of taxes. These people are not paying any taxes, yet they are making, some of them, huge sums of income. And then when they get sick, they get covered by a service that they should have paid for as people who are making an income, but they are not paying for because they are not registered. They are not known that they are in the country.
A whole different debate.
Let me respond to that point. The introduction of NHI did not increase the number of illegal immigrants. Did not increase the number of asylum seekers. So what do you think happens to them now?
No, don't say asylum seekers. You're talking about different things. Let's talk about illegal.
Okay, let's talk about illegal. What do you think happens to them now? They go to clinics and you are paying for it via your taxes.
And that is
so part, why must there be a difference now?
And already that is part of the problem why public health care, many people are dying. For instance, here... Just to finish off my point quickly, Amir. In Gauteng, for instance, in most public hospitals, my brother, you go there as you are sick, you need a bed. I can tell you, there are people who are illegal who are in those beds. At this point in time, you go there, you won't find a bed because there is a fellow that we don't know that is in the country. Who is sleeping in your bed?
It's not your bed. That thing. Secondly,
this is why I love this podcast. This is why you all have to tune in. Tell your friends about it because you're not going to get this level of debate anywhere else. We're going to take a quick break. I'm going to cut it short here before we all get fired. But remember, if you want to advertise on this podcast, email us at smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. That's smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. Join us when we're back.
Racial identity politics. A phrase that has the potential to start an argument in just about any situation. That's why we're starting it first. Let's Start an Argument is a unique and insightful podcast series about the meaning of race to us today. Presented by researcher Cecilia Koch and Doctor of Philosophy Jason Werbeloff, the series aims to spark rational argument and meaningful discussion around this controversial topic. Find Let's Start an Argument now on the Cliff Central app, cliffcentral.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. We're going to get straight back into our next big topic, and that is former Durban Mayor Zandile Gumede, who the axe has finally dropped on after months and months and months, or actually years and years and years, of so many controversies, so many controversies floating around her shoulders. I mean, I can't even begin to start to count how many allegations she's been involved in. There's a lot. Zimase, you reported in KZN before, so you know this case more than most people. Now, the reason why she's been charged is because of her links to a controversial DSW, that's Durban Central Waste. No.
Yeah, that is the legal part of this whole debacle of Zandile Gumede.
So we all know the legal part. She was charged for involvement in siphoning of money and giving a tender to someone who she shouldn't have, and now the match has gone to court. But let's not talk about that because we're not a legal podcast. Let's talk about the political implications. This is where Zimasa's strong point will come in. For the ANC, this was one of Zuma's most staunchest supporters in the province. It was one of his power bases. Now she's gone. It must have been very difficult for the ANC to get rid of her, wasn't it?
It should have been difficult because remember the ANC took this decision in April that comrades who are facing these massive, you know, dirty dark clouds should not be serving in public office or in leadership positions. And they cited that, no, we are protecting our integrity because already people see the ANC as this corrupt organization. That was in April. So these charges came, and in June, the mayor was suspended. But what the ANC did, because Look, the court case is a bit flimsy. There is still investigations. This woman doesn't even know what exactly the charges are. It's been postponed to January next year. So what they were very clever, what they did is they said the PwC will investigate municipalities.
That's the Provincial Working Committee.
The provincial of the ANC.
Yeah.
So the investigations into the going ons in municipalities in KZN, which the ANC is in power, you have Umsunduzi municipality, which is currently under administration because it completely fell apart.
Yeah.
You have eThekwini, which there is a lot of problems there, and some of them are political. Some of them are comrades who don't get along with other comrades and who are making it impossible for people to render services to residents of eThekwini. So, and Empofana. Empofana, there's... Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know. So, I think those So, Empofana is also... There is always some shady things happening there, but we're not going to get into that.
Oh, okay.
So, this 100-page report... said the people that we deployed here at eThekwini, it's not working, they must go.
This is the PwC report now.
This is the PwC. Yeah. So I'm not sure how many people, but I know a huge amount of the ex-corp in eThekwini. Umsunduzi, the mayor is gone, the deputy is gone, Mbofana, I think the mayor is gone also. So when the ANC says that we trusted you with the only metro that we have in the country, and you messed it up. Administratively, you are under investigation for fraud and influencing tender, whatever, whatever. And politically, you are the political head. We trusted you, but there's this infighting within the municipality, within the cadres. You haven't done your job. We do not need you there anymore. Also, if you remember correctly, one of the regions in the May elections, one of the regions in KZN that dropped, I think, 10% was eThekwini. People did not go to vote. There was a lot of protesting and a lot of unrest leading up to the election day. Some people say it was sponsored by some people within the ANC who were aggrieved because of this and that. But the fact is, people from Mlazi, for example, they were jumping rubbish to go to work. Rubbish was not being picked up. So it's a lot. It's a lot. So the ANC put that together and said, you are not
fit,
worthy.
Almost, yeah.
You are not fit to lead. You are not fit for this office. Therefore, thank you for your services. Goodbye.
Yeah. Look, political, what's interesting for me in this case, as you correctly alluded to, that Zandile Gumede is one of the staunchest supporters of former President Zuma. Well, and the support is quite reciprocal there. With Zuma publicly supporting Zandile Gumede during this period. So one would read a situation whereby also, I'm not disputing the fact that there may be legal issues, there may be governance issues that resulted to her being removed, but on the political side as well, it would seem that in a way, this is also a way to deal Zuma a political blow, that being one of the last remaining strongholds where he has some sort of, you know, control, and it's a metro, it's a whole big municipality, metropolitan municipality. But secondly, I have a problem with the ANC and how it takes some of these decisions and the inconsistencies thereof. In that, when also you know, much as Zuma is saying that they did this investigation that they did on the side about other political issues in these municipalities, but the fact of the matter is that as it relates to Zandile Gumede, what was sold to be a part of why she is a problem is the legal issue, which is still pending. Now, when you take a decision like this, you create an impression or a public perception that she is guilty of the legal issues that she is facing, which may not be the case at the end if she is absolved. And initially, when her problem started, the impression you created was that she is corrupt. And you went so far as removing her from the position and the court absolves her. Then you have a serious political problem that will look like you were paging her.
Exactly.
And The inconsistency is that the ANC doesn't take the same steps to the same situations. There are a lot of situations like Zandile Gumede across the country, especially the local government. We know local government is mainly a mess, and we know that the ANC is mainly in charge there. If you take this kind of things, one maybe would argue and say, whatever other municipality, the Rustenburg municipality, if they control it there, for instance, if there are problems, why are you not approaching this holistically and say, as the ANC, because a local government is so much in tatters and we have our deployees in 80-90% of them, we are going to launch, which they did at some point in time, by the way, that the team that was led by Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, and it made recommendations, and the ANC did nothing about it. So now you launch them here and there, here and there, you are going to create an impression that you are using a legitimate process for political reasons to deal with your detractors or your enemies within the ANC factional lines. And that is what I say is a problem here, maybe a problem bigger for the ANC, in that it will seem like they are victimizing her for political reasons, not because they have an interest of saving what could be a metro that is sinking in governance and otherwise.
And she's playing into that gallery also. Remember when she appeared in court, when she was outside court, she was talking of being persecuted. She was saying that there are people who are looking at this metro and thinking, oh, I can have that budget, I can have this money, I can have access to this kind of power, and they can't wait for me to leave. And obviously those people are people from the ANC, because the ANC controls that particular place. But dealing Zuma a blow, I don't think it's...
Should we all get off this thing about dealing Zuma a blow now, and where it happens and how it happens? Is it more just a political thing rather than a Zuma thing?
I think it's more of regional politics that will definitely have national implications at some point, because Etewini region is the biggest region of the ANC. It's the most influential region.
Are we expecting a fight back, Zuma?
Of course. Of course. Oh my God, Mama is a street fighter.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they were not, they decided to do this PwC investigation and say it's not working at the municipality, please leave. Because had they gone the legal route, they were not going to win.
But you see, as I said, Zim, it's going to be a problem, because the impression they created first, what matters is what you do at the beginning, not what you do as a damage control. Because I'm sure they launched the PwC investigation upon realization that the legal reason at the beginning might backfire.
It's not gonna
work. Some people are going to hold on to that initial explanation that you gave of her legal problem.
So,
but, maybe you can we can share this slot.
Sure.
You talk too much on being government spokesperson in Indonesia.
So on the issue of Etegwini as a region, to me I found it interesting. Maybe you can correct me, Zimasa, because you follow it so much. That you are doing this while there is that what you call is it a vibe Ufute, man? It's not a vibe, man. Well, you are in that mood of going to elect new leaders in that region, isn't it?
And
I think it's going to have a bigger influence on those politics, and how are they going to be able to then allow her if she says, okay, now that I'm fired as a mayor, I'm actually running to be the chairperson of Etegwini, are they going to have grounds to say, you know,
actually the bigger issue
you must
there
not
appear to agree with you, hence I'm saying this is going to be a political disaster, because they can't now allow her to run for that position, because that position will again legitimize her to be a mayor maybe after 2021. But how are they going to do that now that Zimasa is telling us that this lady is a street fighter? And we know in the ANC politics, street fighters, when it goes to conferences, especially at the regional level, they always win. And if Zandile takes a decision today that she is going to run in that upcoming regional conference, despite her being fired, and there's nothing they can do about it. And when she wins there, what then?
Well, we've just given her a great idea. Round it up for us, Simon.
I think it's going to be her big comeback, the conference. So the conference should sit between October and February or January.
Mm.
Mama will definitely run.
Okay, explain to our listeners what this conference is about. What happens at this conference?
So the conference is branches of eThekwini electing their regional leadership.
Okay.
Now, the regional leadership of eThekwini is important because obviously it's huge and it's a big metro and there is big money there.
Mm.
So whoever has the region has the access and has the power.
Mm. Mm.
If we can go back briefly, Amil, there was a time when the PEC decided to suspend. When they decided to suspend the mayor, it is around the time when they decided to disband the region because it was way the leadership at the time had expired and they were not getting along, and really they were not getting along. It was divided into two. And the secretary, the provincial secretary and a PEC member called the branches to Moses Mabhida Stadium, told them these are the decisions and the resistance that they encountered there.
Mm.
I think that's when they decided that we cannot go the legal route because we're going to have a problem. And I think at that point, they realized how much power this woman still has. But if you remove her from power now, you remove her from the tenders, from the influence, I don't know how ANC things work, but the people that are on the ground are saying it's very easy to turn ANC branches against someone when you are holding the money and saying, listen, that one has no, they are not going to give you a tender, I'll give you a tender.
Mm.
This is the top five leadership of the region that we're voting for. Forget about that.
Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you all so much for listening. It's been quite an interesting podcast. I wish we could have spoken more about the NHI bill, but maybe we will next week.
We'll give the president an idea if he needs someone who will push the propaganda of NHI. Since they've shifted it to union buildings, here's the mayor.
I'm available to run Mama's Twitter account.
She's going to join.
She must come through. We are ready.
Remember, if you want to advertise on this podcast, email us at smiths@tsoblackstar.co.za. Thank you so much, my colleagues, for joining me in studio this week. And thank you all for listening. We'll catch you again same time next week.